The Tale of the Mole, a Martian Science Odyssey, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Today, a story that is heartbreaking, heroic, and inspiring, brought to us by Troy Hudson of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. Troy was with us when the InSight Mars lander reached the red planet, and we had every reason to believe he'd return to celebrate the success of the Heat Flow and Physical Properties Package, or HP-cubed instrument, more fondly known as the MOLE. Space is hard and Mars is harder, but lessons have been learned. It wasn't designed to do this, but the Parker Solar Probe has somehow peered through the thick cloud surrounding Venus to reveal some murky surface features below. That's the space snapshot that leads this week's edition of The Downlink, the Planetary Society's free newsletter. I bet a lot of you watched the triumphant March 3rd flight and vertical landing of yet another SpaceX spaceship. And I bet you also saw the rocket blown right off the pad minutes later in an unplanned disassembly event. Still, pretty impressive, and SpaceX has the next iteration almost ready for prime time. The downlink wow of the week this week is a 1975 Kitt Peak image of the Pleiades, that most famous of star clusters. It's worth a look, and you'll find it at planetary.org/downlink. Dr. Troy Hudson got his PhD in geological and planetary sciences at Caltech, and it's Caltech that runs the nearby Jet Propulsion Laboratory for NASA, where Troy works as a technologist and instrument systems engineer. Born in Houston, Texas, Troy has spent the last few years working as a liaison and team member with scientists and engineers at the German Aerospace Center, developing HP-cubed, also known as the MOLE. It's why he was on stage with us when this happened on the 26th of November, 2018.
Touchdown confirmed.
Whoa! Yeah!
That was the celebration at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium of the InSight lander's successful touchdown on Mars. Then the work began, soon after followed by the troubles. Troy and the HP-Cube team worked tirelessly and brilliantly for 2 years to get the MOLE under the surface of Mars. Their effort did not end with success. And yet, the story that you're about to hear from Troy demonstrates that their long endeavor was not in vain. Not in the least. Troy, welcome back to Planetary Radio. I am very happy to have you back on as a guest and to congratulate you on all the work that has taken place, even though it may not all have come out exactly as you and the rest of the HP3 team might have wished. And we will get into that, of course. But most of all, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's nice to speak with you again.
I bet you remember where we were at the moment we learned InSight had successfully landed on Mars.
Oh, very much so. I have a painting of it on my wall, in point of fact.
Is that right? Oh, my gosh.
My partner is an artist. He's incredibly skilled with watercolor. And as a Christmas gift, the year that InSight landed, he actually made a painting that is a composite of the lander just before the moment of touchdown and my screaming with joy reaction on the stage at Caltech.
I remember it so well. We shared that celebration with others on the stage. And there were over 1,000 screaming, celebrating InSight fans at Caltech with us that day. It was a full house. It'll always be one of my greatest Planetary Radio memories. I would love to see that painting.
I will be happy to send you a photo of it.
Thank you. Thank you. And ask your partner, hey, maybe we can put it on the show page. But that's entirely up to him, with proper attribution, of course. There was so much work that followed that great day. I don't think I can begin to imagine what you and the rest of the HP3 team, the MOLE team, went through as you worked so hard to achieve the instrument's goals. But we did read about some of what you were up to over that period. How long did all of that work last? And until you just recently, the team had to say, we've done all we can.
Almost exactly 2 Earth years, which is to say just about 1 Mars year. We first attempted to deploy the mole to dig into the ground at the end of February 2019. So since the end of February 2019 until January 9th of 2021, that's about how long it took.
Yeah. I read about some of the extensive research that was done to ensure that the mole would do what it was designed to do. I mean, even including high-speed X-ray photography in a Mars vacuum chamber. I mean, really, it sure wasn't for lack of excellent work designing this device that was intended to do something that nobody had ever attempted before on Mars. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. The mole itself was a unique device in more ways than one. We've flown things like cameras and even robotic arms to other planets before and landed them on other planets, but the instrument complement of InSight with a planetary seismometer and this heat flow probe that it was so tiny, but so powerful and designed to dig so deep. No one had ever attempted something like that without human intervention before.
It was audacious. What were you shooting for? I forget. How many meters would have been ideal?
3 meters was our target, but we had a goal of 5 meters. So that's about 16 feet. Mm-hmm. And the mole itself is about the length of an adult forearm. It's about 40 centimeters long.
Talk about what you went through. I mean, I hate to bring up any painful memories, but I hope that you can take us through the process from the time when, you know, the mole was put in place and you first started this attempt to drill down below the surface.
We'd been on the surface of Mars for a few months at that point, and a lot of things had been going very well. The seismometer was deployed and it was taking data. The rest of the instrument packages on the lander were all working properly. We deployed the support structure to a beautiful site that looked very much like everywhere else that we could reach with the arm. It was ideal in every way we could determine. And there was that day when we had sent the commands, the lander had executed them, and we were waiting to get that data back. We were all sitting in the room at JPL. This was, of course, well before COVID, so we were all clustered. The team from DLR and members of the JPL team clustered in our little room, looking at the computers as the data feeds came back through the Deep Space Network. We knew what we wanted to see, and we saw some information. We saw that the mole had indeed turned on and hammered, but the indications we were hoping for, that it had made that initial penetration, and we were initially on that first day targeting 70 centimeters, so about a little more than 2 feet, and we didn't get that data, and the energy in the room just slowly deflated as we realized there's something going not how we expected. We're going to have to look into this problem. I mean, that was the first indication that something was amiss. As the liaison and the technical liaison between JPL and DLR, it kicked me into high gear of, okay, let's gather all the data we have. And there was quite a bit of it from the mole, from the hammer strokes and the tilt sensor. Let's try to interpret this. Let's try to figure out what do we do next. And as the days turned into weeks, we kept trying to understand the problem, and we brainstormed all the possible things that could be causing us problems. And then over a period of months and even ultimately years, we ticked off those things. That's not the problem. That's not the problem. There was nothing wrong with the mole. There was nothing wrong with the support structure or the tether. And even now, today, the device itself is working exactly as it was built to work. Mm. The mole is tough and robust, and it's doing great. It's just not quite compatible with the soil we encountered on Mars.
And yet, I'm sure that there were endless attempts to simulate Martian soil, Martian regolith, before InSight ever left for the Red Planet.
Yes, we had a number of test beds, both at JPL and at DLR in Germany, where we tested the mole digging under either ambient Earth conditions or close to vacuum Mars conditions, and a variety of different soil types, from what might to you look like loose sandbox sand to a much more difficult soil that was harder for the mole to penetrate through. We tested it in a number of different materials, and we identified there were some cases where the mole's progress wasn't as predictable as others, but everything we expected about the InSight landing area, we thought that it was going to have an easy time with the initial penetration, and that the hard part would come when it got deeper and the soil was harder to move. Turns out it wasn't the case.
Hmm. What conclusions have been reached about the soil and why it prevented the mole from doing what you wanted it to? And I say this to you knowing that you are a geologist, a planetary scientist, your PhD is from Caltech, in addition to your work as an engineer. Do we have guesses at what happened?
We do. The main culprit appears to be a lack of friction. The mole works very much like a nail. When you nail into a piece of wood, you don't pull the wood out of the hole like you would with a normal drill. You push it out of the way. And that nail stays in place because of the friction of the material around it. The mole, in order to make progress, hammers forward very strongly, but rebounds just a little bit. And that rebound has to be absorbed or reacted by something on the outside. When we first put the mole on the surface, it was in this big support structure that had some springs that provided friction to the side of the mole to let it make progress downwards. But once it got out of the support structure, we had designed it for the soil to provide that friction. But it wasn't doing that. The soil was sticking to itself more than it was sticking to the mole.
You have heard the saying, space is hard. I often add to that, space is hard, Mars is harder. You seem to have had good evidence of that. As the team came to realize that you were facing this challenge, some of the very innovative work that took place, particularly with that arm that this, I don't think was it planned that you might be able to use the arm to help the mole get a grip, so to speak?
It was never intended for the arm to interact with the mole directly in any way. The arm has had a grapple hook attached to it, which we used to deploy the instruments and a camera that we used to survey the site and confirm that our instrument placement was as expected. But we did have to invent new processes, new procedures for that arm.
Eventually, that day came when you and the team had to tell the world, we've done everything we can. Can you take us to that day and sort of your sense of it?
Well, what happened was prior to Christmas 2020, things were getting rather difficult on Mars. Dust continues to accumulate on the solar panels, and we were in the depths of Martian winter. And upcoming is a conjunction event where Mars will be on the far side of the sun and we won't be able to talk to it for a while. So for all of these reasons, and the fact that there wasn't much more we could do with the arm to help the mole, it was now almost out of reach. We came to the decision that this is one last chance to see if the mole can make progress on its own. Every time we'd help the mole with the arm, either pushing on it from the side or from the back with the scoop, and we hammered, it made progress. It dug down into the soil. It was only when we didn't have the arm quite helping it that we had those horrific back-out events that occurred in October of 2019. Fast forward again to Christmas of 2020. We were all in position to do the hammering. And then we had our Christmas holiday break. I was able to not think about Mars for a few weeks, which was a blessed vacation. And then we came back and we were ready to do this final test. See if the mole, you've gotten it deep enough, got enough friction, got enough soil behind it. Can it dig on its own? And when that data came down and it showed that it couldn't, it was an odd, weird mix of emotions for me. For 2 years, I'd been, and we all had been hoping and believed that there was a chance that the mole could get to a place where it could dig on its own. And Mars kept teasing us. It kept showing us, well, yes, look, you can dig. There's not a rock blocking you. You can go deeper. Oh, but you really have to be touching it with the arm, otherwise it backs out. And this roller coaster of emotions of, yes, it works. No, it's not working. Yes, this could work. No, that didn't work. And just up and down and up and down. And when that final test showed us that it did not go and that the line that we had drawn for ourselves had passed, I was sad. I was relieved. I was in this unusual place of finally being able to start processing the emotions that I had been holding in check for 2 years. Because the whole process with the mole, for me, being emotionally invested in it, was being in the midst of a crisis that has not yet resolved. And I knew that if we ultimately succeeded with the mole, or ultimately were unable to penetrate, that would affect how I processed the whole experience. But until we got to that point, I couldn't process it. I couldn't really deal with it because I didn't know the outcome. And I think everybody in the world now identifies with the feeling of being in the midst of a crisis that goes on for longer than anyone should have to endure. It's a completely different thing with COVID, but the sense of I'm in the middle of a crisis and it's still happening and it's still happening and it's still happening, that was finally over. Since then, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the good things that came out of this. And despite the fact we didn't ultimately succeed, it was a success because we got to try. We got to do everything possible with the arm, with the mole, everything we could have done to make this work, we got to try. And even though it ultimately didn't succeed, darn it, we were able to do everything we could.
I am so glad that you have been left with that conclusion. And I hope you know that there were a lot of us out here around the world, certainly I was one of them, who was following the progress and then the reversals for the mole, the rise in hope and hopes that were then dashed. There were a lot of us pulling for you.
As it happens, the mole story is not over. It may not be able to dig any deeper, but the mole itself, the body of the mole, is constructed to also be a temperature probe, a probe of thermal properties. And now that it's fully buried, we can use the mole to measure the thermal conductivity of the soil. And it turns out on Mars, the thermal conductivity is very strongly controlled by the amount of pressure, air pressure, gas pressure in the pores. And on Mars, from winter to summer, as the ice caps form and disappear, the pressure changes. And we want to measure that change in the soil over the Martian seasons.
That's excellent news. And of course, we have talked with people like Bruce Bannert about the success of that other part of the InSight payload, the seismograph, which has just been spectacular, hasn't it?
It has. And it's taught us a lot about Mars. It's an exquisitely sensitive device, as you know. And Mars is a much quieter place than Earth, seismically speaking. It doesn't have oceans sloshing around. It doesn't have plate tectonics grinding against one another. It doesn't have human activity shaking the surface. So Mars is seismically a very quiet place. Since we deployed it on Mars, we've detected almost 500 Mars quakes.
Wow.
But they're all less than a Richter magnitude 4. They're all very weak and very quiet. And maybe we haven't been there long enough to really hear one of the rarer, bigger events. Yeah, but Mars has surprised us again in that it's quite quiet.
Thank you, Troy. This has been yet another delightful conversation, and I am extremely grateful to you for returning to the show and sharing everything that that we've just talked about. And I look forward to another conversation. Please convey the gratitude of all of us at the Planetary Society to the entire InSight team, and our best wishes for continued success. And I do include the mole in that statement as we explore our solar system and beyond.
Thank you so much, Matt. And I will pass on your thoughts. It's exciting to be part of something like that, and I'm sure they will appreciate what you said.
Keep up the great work, and thanks again, Troy.
My pleasure.
Troy Hudson and I talked about much more, including the exciting new work he has taken on at JPL, and more of his personal reflections. You can hear it all at planetary.org/radio. Bruce Betts and this week's What's Up are next. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Davis, editorial director for the Planetary Society. Did you know there are more than 20 planetary science missions exploring our solar system? That means a lot of news happens in any given week. Here's how to keep up with it all. The Downlink is our new roundup of planetary exploration headlines. It connects you to the details when you want to dive deeper. From Mercury to interstellar space, we'll catch you up on what you might have missed. That's The Downlink, every Friday at planetary.org.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related. We invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
Time yet again for What's Up on Planetary Radio. So we have the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. Bruce Betts is here to tell us about the night sky and solve yet another mystery as he provides the answer to the space trivia contest question he posed 2 weeks ago. And it's another one with a pretty good, fun twist. Welcome.
Thank you, Matt. Let's stick with something less tricky, which is the night sky. Mars and Aldebaran are looking like lovely twins in the evening south, both looking like reddish, fairly bright, but not extremely bright stars. They're really fun to check out. They're very similar in brightness right now, although Mars is now a little bit dimmer. And the 19th of March, they will be hanging out near a crescent moon, making for a more lovely situation. Mars is also passing by the Pleiades and is in between Aldebaran and the Pleiades. So check out red-looking stars in the south-southwest in the early evening. In the pre-dawn, Jupiter, Saturn, still low to the horizon in the east, but coming up higher, Jupiter super bright, Saturn up above it looking yellowish. On to this week in space history. It was 240 years ago, Matt. You know what I'm talking about. That's right. William Herschel discovered Uranus 240 years ago. I'm impressed if you know that, or at least that was the official discovery.
I forgot, but the official, right? Because didn't somebody else find it but not realize it was a planet, or was that Neptune?
No, Uranus as well. I mean, in fact, Uranus from a dark sky is visible barely with good eyesight. So conceptually, it had been seen many a time and been observed in older data, but Herschel was the first to connect the dots to, hey, it's a new planet, new, so to speak.
Nice work, Will.
Very, very good job, William. 15 years ago, a little bit closer back in time, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter arrived at Mars, and it's still taking amazing images, including an image of Perseverance under parachute just a little bit ago.
Just amazing to see. And of course, people can find a lot of this stuff at planetary.org.
On to Random Space Fact. Probably wondered about Perseverance relative to Curiosity. And how about their relative masses? Well, Perseverance, with larger instruments, new sampling and caching system, and modified wheels, makes Perseverance more massive by about 14% at 1,025 kilograms compared to Curiosity at 899 kilograms.
You know, my grandson believes that Perseverance and Curiosity will eventually meet and shake hands and work together on Mars. So I have not disabused him of that nice image.
Well, that would be unexpected. On to the confusing trivia question. I asked you, how many uncrewed space flights have there been to the International Space Station? There are a few ways to answer this. What would people tell us, Matt?
Apparently wasn't too difficult to find the basic answer in the Wikipedia. Damn that Wikipedia. But here is an answer that incorporates some of the confusion that people had from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild. Bruce has asked another of his tricky questions, yes, wondering on uncrewed missions to the ISS. The answer is 135, because the first in air reached the proper orbit, but no ISS was there. This Russian Zarya spacecraft brought up Module 1. That's all there was for 18 months. The job was nowhere done. Another section came up then on 26 July, and that's the start of uncrewed flights to castles in the sky. Good work, Dave. 136, if you include that first flight. A lot of people pointed out that six of them did not make it. There were six failures, apparently. I think I know about one or two of those. Didn't know there were six, but is that an adequate answer?
That is definitely an adequate answer. Sorry about the trickiness. I should have thought this one through. So anything from 129, 130 to 136, what random.org happened to find us?
Random.org found us a brand new first-time winner, Matthew Eason in Virginia. Man, Virginia has been overrepresented among winners lately. There's something going on here. He said there have been 136 attempts at uncrewed spaceflights to the ISS, five of which failed to reach orbit and or the ISS. That left 131 successful uncrewed spaceflights, including modules. So he even incorporated that extra little twist there. He says, I hope no one edited the Wikipedia. No, apparently not before you got to it anyway, Matthew. So congratulations. We're going to send you a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, specifically a Kick Asteroid rubber asteroid. Congratulations. Yeah, let's go on.
What was the original name of the Mars InSight mission? Go to planetary.org/radio contest. It had an official name before InSight.
Yeah, I have to admit, I don't know this one, but I bet you do, or you will, if you enter and win yourself. We'll do it one more time, and maybe not for a long time after this. So if you want your shot at one of those rubber asteroids, here you go. You got until Wednesday, March 17th. At 8 a.m. Pacific time to get in on this contest.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about helicopters. Thank you, and good night.
Bruce knows we're under the Navy flight path here from Coronado, from the Navy base there, and it gets a little noisy sometimes. He's Bruce Betts, the chief of... That's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its persevering members. Mark Hilverdez, our associate producer, Josh Doyle, composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.